welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, here we are again, top of a new week. Thank you for joining me for another episode. This week, I have another interview for you. Back in season 1, episode 20, I did an episode on how to conduct constructive conversations, how to have those difficult dialogues. And at the end of that episode, I did a small book review on a book I really appreciated and I thought was right to the point, and that was Radical Candor. Now, I thought it was such a great book, I wanted someone from the Radical Candor organization to come speak about the book. So I sent them an email, and they were very responsive. You know, the day after, I got a response, and Amy Sandler, she agreed to be on, and that is the guest I have today. So who is Amy Sandler? Well, Amy Sandler is the Chief Content Officer at Radical Candor, where she's also a candor coach and host of the Radical Candor podcast. She's trained tens of thousands of people across a spectrum of roles, including CEOs and leadership teams, mid-level and new managers, and individual contributors just starting on their career path. Now, as an executive coach, corporate mindfulness trainer, and professional speaker, Amy has more than 20 years of experience in senior roles, including Young Presidents Organizations, or YPO, Vistage, and UCLA. She has an AB and MBA from Harvard University and an MFA in screenwriting from UCLA, and was one of the first 30 certified teachers of the Search Inside Yourself leadership program developed by Google. Now, in our first part of a conversation, Amy talks about her experience and what the lessons she's learned from doing mindfulness and how that's helped her to become so much easier to become self-aware. Now, all of us know that moving into some level of conflict or having a constructive dialogue, however we want to frame it, it's not always easy. Most of us would choose to avoid it. Why? Because we don't want to hurt the other person or we don't want to hurt ourselves. And so going into a constructive conflict, usually the first hurdle is trying to find the confidence in ourselves to have the conversation. Then the next one is to actually have the conversation. That's the second hurdle. And so mindfulness is just that. If we become aware, we become self-aware, and we're self-aware of our thoughts and our emotions around it. And that self-awareness can give us an advantage to build up our confidence to have those constructive dialogues. Self-awareness is so intimately connected to emotional intelligence, and that's what we need. We need to have these large social emotional intelligence when we are having difficult conversations, because the whole point of having these types of dialogues is to help the other person move from wherever they're stuck to move forward, to take the next step forward, to progress. I had a lot of fun talking to Amy, and I hope you find her passion, her vibrancy as infectious as I did. Well, anyways, let's slip into the stream and meet Amy Sandler. Well, welcome, Amy, to It's an Inside Job. I am glad we were able to coordinate time zones, considering you're all the way in L.A.
Yes, all the way from L.A. And hi, Jason. It's great to connect. And I'd say one of the wonderful things about technology is that we can be in the same place at the same time, even though I believe you're 8 hours ahead of me.
Well, I'm just really glad our calendars could overlap and we could find this time to have a conversation. I was wondering, Amy, to begin the conversation, I was wondering if you could tell us a little about who you are and what you're about.
Sure. Well, that could either be a really short conversation or even more exciting, a long conversation. But for the listeners, just at a high level, I am the Chief Content Officer at Radical Candor. Radical Candor is an executive education company based on the best-selling book. I'm also a coach at Radical Candor, as well as a coach for other professionals. I'm a speaker, a mindfulness trainer, as well as the podcast host of Radical Candor.
Yeah, I saw that your title is Mindful Leader when I checked out your LinkedIn, when I did a little sort of background research before the interview. I was wondering if you could maybe speak to that mindful leader or that mindfulness that you speak to.
Sure. Well, I think now it's something that people really understand the value of. I think it's important to actually define words so that we're all on the same page. And I've been practicing mindfulness off and on, more on the last 10 years, but off and on actually for about 30 years. I've really been on a path of personal development, spiritual development for certainly more than half of my life. I was very much on a success track of, you know, go to Harvard Business School, just try to do what it seemed like success and happiness was. And along the way, just realizing that actually doesn't give this sort of inner sense of worth and peace. And so I was, you know, while I was at Harvard Business School in the mid 90s, I was doing meditation and yoga and things that just weren't done at Harvard Business School in the mid 90s. So in many ways, I was living kind of two different lives on that path of mindfulness and self-awareness. And so it's really exciting now, you know, fast forward 25 years to where the world is. Just about 10 years ago, I was one of the first 30 people accepted into the Search Inside Yourself program. This was a mindfulness-based emotional intelligence program that was developed at Google, and they created the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute to train people to teach it outside of Google. So I was one of the first people trained to teach that. And what was exciting for me, and just knowing your background, was the neuroscience that really infused that. In that time, this was really, I think, the first, certainly one of the first, if not the first, training programs like it. Obviously now, 8-9 years later, there's so much of that, but this really came for me. My mindfulness journey came first just from a desire to address my own internal suffering, depression, anxiety, challenges of, sure. You know, how do you find a sense of inner peace? And then I think what's beautiful about these practices is that the more you do it, you realize, oh, actually what I want to do is to share what I've learned and be of service for other folks. And I think that's where the leadership peace comes in. And what's really exciting is that I think we're redefining what it means to be a leader. Maybe we won't even need to have mindful in front of leader. It's just part of what leadership is.
Yeah, because I read a little about that program you're talking about, Google. And what I really liked about it, it was very secular and it was very evidence-based. It's very science-based. And I think that's the grounding, because many of us Westerners are very sort of skeptical and we are very critical and we need that science base. Not to say that some of the esoteric part of it is not important, but I think in that corporate space, especially in the Western world, I think that is very important. When you can nail it down to science, it's evidence-based and it's secular. It still has the same impact. We just, you know, package it with a different ribbon, I think. I was wondering.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's a huge point, and it just might be of interest for you, just where the world is. When I first went through the training, the neuroscience, the research, I mean, it was a very rigorous year-long training program, and the amount, the quantity of studies that we had to analyze, and in fact, you know, the advisors on that program were folks like Richie Davidson out of the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin. And I think Philippe Golden, I believe from Stanford, you know, very top scientists. And this is because, you know, again, it originally came out of Google. And just if you want to know the origin story, you might find interesting. Mm-hmm. They first wanted to bring mindfulness-based stress reduction to Google engineers. They thought, oh, folks are stressed. We have a mindfulness-based stress reduction. Nobody signed up. They didn't sign up because they were concerned, well, if I get my stress reduced, I'm not going to be able to do very good work. And there is some, you know, merit and there's a value. There is, you know, sort of eustress versus distress, a value of having some, you know, positive stress. And I think the real aha came from when they realized, oh, the awareness that arises by practicing mindfulness. And again, now we're starting to see it through at that time, fMRIs, and we're starting to see what's happening in the brain. That same awareness that's cultivated through mindfulness training is in fact the same awareness that's foundational to practicing emotional intelligence. And there was enough research around, you know, the benefits of emotional intelligence. So, oh, we can train mindfulness to develop emotional intelligence. And I will say that the quantity of research that was required in 2014 when I went through the program is far less than it is now 8 years later, because I think it has been so accepted. But there was a lot of science. It is very science and evidence based. And I will say that I will always instruct people, especially, you know, CEOs or skeptics, but any, like you say, any Westerner or any human, like try it out for yourself, see what works. Like you're going to be your own best lab. So I think the science is a great like door in. And then I like to just think about, just have an experimenter's mindset. Like, how might this practice work for you? What do you notice? If it works, great. If it doesn't, toss it.
Hey there, I'm Dave.
And I'm Greg. And we host the Unconventional Therapist Guide to Nothing,
a podcast all about mental health.
Well, Dave, I'd say it's more about psychology.
Yeah, but it's also true crime.
It's kind of about societal phenomenon and odd historical figures.
And cults.
Sometimes it's spooky, though.
How about this? This is the Unconventional Therapist Guide to Nothing.
So whether you're looking to work on your mental health, learn about history and society, or just have a few laughs, check us out. We're two licensed therapists trying to understand the world's anomalies.
Join us as we discuss the most interesting topics in a way that helps you better understand yourself, the world, and the people around you.
Now, I think what you said there, the instructions, because you are a mindful leader and you have deep experience and knowledge in that to help people. Because I think mindfulness in itself as a word gets bandied around. And I think mindfulness without structure, without training, can actually be detrimental to some people who are dealing with a very inner critic with anxiety or depression, because people can get trapped even deeper into rumination. And I think professionals like you who provide a structured way for mindfulness is very important, because there's that support. I mean, once you understand the idea and the depth and the techniques and the strategies behind it, then it's then you can go off on your own. But I think it's like anything else. You need to learn a structured practice to it, because I've read many documents and papers on the mindfulness where it can be a slippery slope into the abyss. But from what your perspective is, it actually brings peace of mind, because there's a structured way. And as you said, there was a deep training. And that was 2014. Fast forward to 2022. The science is evolved even further than that.
Absolutely. And I will say you bring up a really important point, which is what, you know, wasn't as much brought in 2014 is absolutely brought in now, especially with the past few years, is, you know, trauma infused practices, trauma supported practices, realizing that some of these practices may be contraindicated for certain folks, and you don't necessarily know, you know, who's in your room. And so even things like following the breath might be triggering for someone. And so actually, you know, feeling, you know, placing your intention on the palms or on part of the body, et cetera. So I think, first of all, bringing trauma awareness to it. And certainly if someone does have that as a background, actually seeing someone with a more, you know, with a trained certification, a therapist, a licensed professional, I think looking at people's certifications and licensing, especially depending on your background, if there is trauma. So I think that's absolutely very important. And the other thing I will say is that certainly for my own journey with mindfulness, the reason why it was so off and on was because I didn't necessarily want to be sitting with all of the thoughts that were going around in my head. And I think people have this idea of, oh, mindfulness means I'm just not going to have any thoughts. When in fact, no, what it means is you're becoming aware of all of the thoughts. There was a study out of Harvard that showed that, you know, 47% of the time we're thinking about something that is not happening in the present moment. We're sort of going into the future, into the past. And so for me, where the science was really helpful was, rather than like, oh, something is wrong with you that you have a hard time paying attention, it's like, no, actually, this is how we're wired. And so it took away some of that self, that self blame, and actually gave practices. But gosh, once I started becoming aware of my thoughts, I realized, wow, there's a whole lot of judgment, self-judgment, outer judgment, and just becoming, tapping into that can be challenging if you're not doing it in a safe way.
And I think that's important because I spoke to a neuroscientist, Jill Bolte Taylor. Earlier this week. And, you know, we were talking about...
That's very exciting. I love her work.
Make connection. Yeah. Yeah, she's on the East Coast or you're on the West. But anyways, but she talked about, you know, there's two rational centers and two emotional centers where the left is much more about details. And it's not like left is rational and the right is creative. I mean, that's 1980s silly management speak, right? But it's just that what you're saying is where the left, like the amygdala, that emotional center, here we feel emotions. But on the right amygdala, it's more about we feel experiential. You know, as you're saying, what we listen, how we are present. Because what you said about that Harvard paper, from my experience working with anxiety and depression and the corporate world, it is so true what you said. It's such a salient point because I think something they bandy around the number 50, 60% of our thoughts are about the future. Now, that's okay if you're strategizing, but most of us are speculating about the future. And then the other 40% is about, you know, something that happened in the past, some failure. And then, okay, that's a predictor of how everything else is going to play out. And I think very conservatively, I think only 2 to 5% of our time are we actually present with ourselves. Most of the times we're on robot mode where we're just executing on all the habits.
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, I think that's for me why the benefit of mindfulness, I really see, and I mean, there's a lot of types of practices when we talk about mindfulness sort of writ large, but I think without the ability to focus our attention, you know, everything else, all of these other practices, they don't really have a foundation. We need, especially now when we're getting so many inputs and so many distractions, we need that capacity to come back to our own attention. Now, there's also a benefit sometimes for mind wandering and creative thinking, you know, but I think having that muscle of being able to, oh, notice I'm distracted and come back is fundamental to our ability to, first of all, find a little bit more peace, but to your point, actually be a successful leader, because a leader is going to get bombarded by so much information at them. And there's a value for strategizing and there's a value for sort of looking back at what didn't work, but that's not necessarily the quality of those sort of the future worry, the worrying and the regrets, which is what you were talking about, sort of the emotional salience part of it.
And I think, you know, being physically supple and flexible is just as important. I mean, mentally being supple and flexible is just as important as what is our sort of physical flexibility. To have that mental flexibility, to be able to shift mindsets, to be able to shift from the granular to the global, from the subjectives to the objectives, the personal to the whatever, the public. And it's to shift that. And that reframing is so important. And mindfulness does give you that reframe because you become... Forgive my parlance, it's from a place of ignorance, but where you move from subjective to objective, you tend to observe yourself, whether it's your breathing or your thoughts or what have you. Is that what I understand mindfulness is from your expertise?
Yeah, I mean, I think just definitionally, there's actually quite a bit going on. One definition I like, I believe, comes from the Mindful UK, where it's really this awareness that comes from, you know, the present moment, paying attention in the present moment. So it's sort of, we are here now, like in this conversation, I'm noticing that I'm speaking with you. I'm looking into a camera, present moment awareness. I'm paying attention. So there's actually some intention there. I am intentionally paying attention, non-judgmentally, you know, and I think the attitude is very important. That attitude of kindness and curiosity is also important, because sometimes what can happen is we start to pay attention in the present moment and we're like, why am I thinking about that? Why are you doing that? You're doing this again. And then we start sort of beating ourselves up, or, oh, I just got distracted, and we beat ourselves up again. So there's really an attitude of kindness and curiosity. But then there's an awareness that arises, and that is this experiential thing that's, you know, it's a little harder to put into words for folks, but we've had those moments, you know, when we're sort of looking at the sunset, or, you know, we were just talking about cats, you know, with a pet, those sort of moments of awareness. And I think just there's two practices. One is that focused attention. So we're really creating that ability to have a pointed concentration, sort of a meta awareness where we're really concentrated. And then there's open awareness where you're actually just kind of resting in the moment, where the concentration has gotten us to a place where we can actually let go of the object of attention, whether it was the breath or whether it was the body or whether it was sensations. We let go of that focus, and we're really resting in whatever is presenting in the moment. And when you're talking about as a leader that need to be able to shift to both, I mean, I think about it all the time when I'm in a workshop and it's mediated right now through the video screen, which is tiring, right? You're speaking, you're maybe responding to one person's question at the same time you're trying to hold what's happening for the whole group. How will this land for the whole group? And so that's where we need both that sort of focused attention as well as that more open awareness. And it's a training that we do in advance of those sessions, but those sessions become kind of the on the court play where we get to put it in action.
I was just wondering, because I think all you're saying are very salient points. And once we are in the pilot seat of our minds, then it's easier for us to employ what we've learned technique-wise to help us shift to a more objective, reflective mindset. But when we're in the midst and we're completely engaged in some subjective emotional storm, and we get so lost in the cyclical nature of negative spirals or negative thinking, overthinking, rumination, how does one become self-aware so they can go into meditation or they can go into mindfulness or they can, you know, override their reactive primal mindset?
Well, if I had a perfect answer to that, I probably would be on an island somewhere.
Come on, you know, Amy, you have a
pina coladas. But I will share certainly what, you know, I've my own experience and just from, you know, the research, which is really, you know, I like to think of the work we do sort of on the cushion or in the chair. We're building the capacity, kind of the stamina to have maybe some of these difficult conversations. So part of it is self-awareness, knowing kind of what things set you off. And for me, a lot of that, it lives in the body. And so I think for me, you know, having been a very academic person, all of a sudden I realized, you know, oh, my brain isn't just carrying along this thing. Like there's a body and the body has so much wisdom. And, you know, I'm sure you know that just the data of like, our body is actually going to give us information quicker than our, you know, prefrontal cortex.
Sort of embodied cognition you speak to, right?
Correct. And so there's going to be, you know, for me, when I know I'm starting to get angry, I feel it in my neck. And so there are these signals, if we can actually start to listen to what our body is telling us. So I've done a lot of other practices, not just mindfulness, where there's body scans where you can actually pay attention to the body, but I do an active breath work where it actually releases a lot of emotional energy. So very active breathing. I've actually in the last couple of years started doing a Qigong teacher training because first of all, I've learned that the way that I learn is by becoming a teacher and it becomes a virtuous cycle. And what I love about Qigong is that it is a moving meditation in many ways and your eyes are actually open. And so you're starting to train with how you can have more connection with your body and with your sort of the energy areas in a way while you're actually like we are in our meetings, you know, looking out in the world with our open eyes. So all of these additional practices have helped give me almost like a more and more pixels in a camera, like higher resolution into what's happening in my body and giving me more emotional awareness so that, for example, and I think we'll probably get into talking about radical candor.
Definitely.
One of our CEO, Jason Rozoff, we have a fantastic relationship and there's so much trust and care. And I got this email about a new project and I was expecting that I would have been involved in that project. And I was aware that I was feeling frustration when I read the email. And so I sent a note and I said, hey, can we chat? And so I went into that conversation thinking like, when you're in those modes of being sort of triggered, especially around like identity and self and ownership, it's like me and mine. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even thinking that there was a possibility of like another reason why this might be that, like, it just wasn't even there. But I did try to, you know, prepare for the conversation in a way of, you know, well, you know, how can I show up in a way that's kind and caring? But I was still like convinced I was pretty right. And I shared my perspective and he said, oh, you know, that's really interesting. I don't see it that way at all. I actually see it this way. And he shared his perspective, which is really when we're talking about radical candor, you know, it's really about sharing perspective. I said, oh, I don't see it that way at all. And then he said, you know, and I'm aware I'm feeling some real frustration. And, you know, cause we talk about our emotion, we have a high degree of sort of emotional awareness. And I said, well, I'm feeling some frustration too. And I'm sorry that you're feeling frustrated, because I'm really surprised. And, you know, so we were able to kind of name what was happening in each of our, you know, sort of emotionally as well as sort of cognitively how we were seeing it. And we came to a really great place. And I will say, you know, I've never worked in a place where I've been able to have these kinds of relationships, which is great because also, you know, we're teaching it. But I bring that up. It's just one example. But I had to do so much work, you know, where when I was on at a job, you know, 15 years ago, and I had this dog that I loved, and I would be walking on the beach, and it's a beautiful day, and it's the waves are rolling in, and this beautiful dog, and everything looks beautiful. And what is happening in my mind, except I am reading an email that I had received from someone, and I'm getting filled with rage as I'm thinking about this email. And then I'm writing this very clever response in my head, and I have missed the entire walk. And so for me, it was realizing just, you know, how much of my work I was actually allowing to take over my sort of mental and emotional well-being, and realizing that these practices could really help me stay more focused, and not to, you know, negate that I'm having the emotional experience, but not be overwhelmed by it. So part of what happens is when you notice it, and especially when you notice it's in the body, then you can actually allow it to move through the body, but not be sort of captive to it.
Well, I think that's the key word. You notice it. So you become the observer. You're not identifying mm-hmm. with the emotion, because yeah, you're going to have emotions. You can't stop the emotions. I don't even like, I used to call them positive or negative. For me, they're more sort of uncomfortable and comfortable emotions, but all emotions are trying to communicate something, because we don't have grammar syntax. They are chemical recipes of neuromodulators and hormones that are trying to communicate something to our brain, that embodied cognition, to our cognition,
yeah,
and saying, hey, Amy, hey, Jason, you got to address something in your environment. But as you said, I think that was a very salient example, very clear example of you walking on the beach. You have everything's going on.
Yeah.
It's a very right hemisphere thing. You know, you have this holistic yeah. picture, and you're actually kind of part of the surroundings, but your left is like an angry dog with a bone, not to yeah. play on dogs, but you know, you just... Right.
I had the really great happy dog, and then this other, you know, the
your mental dog was like going nuts.
My mental dog was like, where's the bone? But you know, you bring yeah. it up, and I love what you're saying about emotions, because I've really been working with the idea of emotional habits and becoming really conscious of what my emotional habits are, and sort of these grooves that happen. If someone says something, and I have sort of that habituated response to it, and then it becomes, and we think it's us, you know, one of the reasons why I love the Search Inside Yourself program was I was learning some different ways to reframe. So one around emotions was, rather than, you know, I am angry, you know, sort of the shift to I'm experiencing anger. And when we realize like, oh, anger, it's something, it's, you know, it's physiological. Plus I have, it's mediated through my history with this sensation. It really is. There's a sensation, you know, I'm calling it anger. I'm experiencing it as anger. And then the other thing of which I'm sure you know is, you know, just that beautiful quote that's been, you know, sort of ascribed to Viktor Frankl, you know, that space between stimulus and response. And sort of it's in that space where we really, you know, that's sort of our final freedom. And that's really, for me, what these practices do is, how can I create some more space from that stimulus, that email? You know, I haven't gotten to the point where I don't, you know, sort of still get a little set off by things. But what I have gotten much better at is my sort of ROI, my sort of reaction time of when I notice that I'm set off. And it's not sort of propelling me for the rest of the day. And I think a lot of what happens for folks in the workplace is something sets us off in the morning and we're feeling really frustrated at a meeting at 3 p.m., you know, 8 hours later, and we don't know why. It's like, oh, there was that thing that, you know, happened and I've been carrying it with me all day and I haven't really had a chance to disperse. And it's really energy. I haven't had a chance to disperse that energy that got stuck.
Yeah, and I think, you know, back to the original question, you answered in the sense that, you know, you need to practice it. You need to create a new default habit so you capture yourself. As you said, you can, I can't remember, you said you have some sort of physical sensation.
Yeah.
And that becomes a trigger or becomes a, hello, Amy, wake up here. There's something going on. And then you
yes.
get your self-awareness or you get into the pilot seat and then you practice your techniques or your mindfulness and such.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to, that's, thank you for bringing that back. So specifically for the question of how do you deal with emotions? You know, I see it as one is there's that sort of dedicated practice, which is the training time. So I'm doing mindfulness practices, breath work, you know, Qigong. So there's sort of the, if you think about like someone, an athlete playing the sport, this is sort of your practice periods and you're, you know, practicing free throws and all of that. And then you're, you know, in the court or in the field with, you know, your colleagues or at home, and you have this awareness now of where your sort of triggers are, where your go-tos are, but you've also built up the capacity. And so I will say, you know, when something happens in the spot, I have that practice to rely on. And then I also just will have some, I mean, even I'm someone that actually like, I like to sometimes squeeze something if I'm aware that I'm feeling some stress from a conversation. I'll actually like squeeze something to just kind of disperse the stress a little bit. So some of it are just little tools kind of on the spot in the moment. And one of the interesting things with Zoom or anywhere, but like nobody knows you're taking kind of a deep belly breath, you know, and the deeper belly breath, you know, diaphragmatic breathing can really just, you know, start to bring on the parasympathetic system, you know, calming your system exactly. down. I mean, just the physiology. So there's things that you can do in the moment to try to calm that reaction. And then sometimes if it's really heated, just say, you know, yourself well enough and say, hey, this is really important to me. I'm aware. I'm feeling a bit, you know, activated or kind of fired up about this. Can I just take 10 minutes and come back with you? So some of it's knowing yourself, some of it, you know, can I do this sort of on the spot, kind of going through a little bit of a body scan. And if I can't, then just take a break.
In the second part of our conversation, Amy and I explore radical candor, and we break it down where we look at psychological safety, the feedback, building a feedback culture, and how we can script our words, how we can craft our words if we're managers and leaders, because most of us out there want to see our employees, our coworkers, and our peers develop and perform. But sometimes we're not always gifted with the word craft. And radical candor shows us how, in very practical, pragmatic terms, on how to do this. And so I hope you enjoy this second part. The mindfulness is so important. I think, as you said, it's linking to, not everyone's gone through trauma, but our societies have been shaken up for the last 2 years. And we are coming out of some sort of post-trauma. And the conversation is not about stress, but it's about, in a sense, using mindfulness, as you said, structured and guided mindfulness to create more post-traumatic growth, to deal with the anxiety, the social anxieties, the isolation, the depression, whatever we want to call it. And as we're moving back into work. And so I'd like just to shift to this brilliant book, Radical Candor, and kind of bridge that connection. I was wondering, could you speak briefly what Radical Candor is about, Amy?
Absolutely. So Radical Candor is a book written by Kim Scott. Kim and I actually went to business school together, although we didn't know each other at business school. We reconnected, we had mutual friends, and we reconnected about 10 or 15 years ago. And I think the reason why it's such a successful book is because it taps into a really simple idea, which is not so simple to put into practice. But the simple idea is that we can actually care about the people that we work with as real human beings at the same time that we're willing to challenge them directly. You know, and I think often what happens is at work, and also outside of work, because this is really just about human relationships, is that we feel like we either have to be super direct and just challenge someone, you know, where's the email, where's the project, throwing things, yelling, you know, public criticism, which we call obnoxious aggression, where we kind of forget to care personally, or we make other kinds of mistakes. And, you know, Kim came up with this sort of 2x2 grid. You know, you think about sort of care personally on the vertical axis and challenge directly on the horizontal axis. And it becomes actually a really helpful mental model. I think as humans, you know, you're cognitive scientists, you know, we like these sort of mental frameworks. And so radical candor would sort of be in that top right where you're caring and you're challenging. And that obnoxious aggression is when you are kind of acting like a jerk. Now, interestingly, She was going to call this the asshole quadrant, but she didn't for two reasons. One is because it's not a very nice word, although it could be technically more direct. But
it's clear.
This is not like, it's clear. The Myers-Briggs, like, this is not like a Myers-Briggs personality test. You know, this framework, what we really encourage people to do is use the framework in conversations to guide them to a better place. And so it's like, I don't like to think I'm a jerk, but I know I've acted like a jerk sometimes. You know, it's just, it's part of being human. I've certainly acted that way. If I've been on, you know, if it's the ninth customer service person I've just been transferred to, you know, it's like, it's not my best self, right? And then often after we've acted like a jerk, rather than kind of moving up on care personally, we move over into what's called manipulative insincerity, where we kind of check out. We're not caring about the person. We're not challenging them. This is, you know, if you've ever watched Netflix and spent more time than you meant to over a weekend, this is like the sort of gossip and talking about people, not to people, and sort of the backstabbing. And it's really the most toxic of workplaces. But I think the vast majority of mistakes, certainly that I make, but that we see in workplaces, is this idea of ruinous empathy, where we care so much about the folks that we work with. We don't want to hurt their feelings. And I think especially now where it's like, oh, they've got so much on their plate and I don't want to just throw another thing on their plate. So we don't tell them the thing they need to do. And then 6 months later, we're firing them. And I had a, you know, situation where a relationship that really meant a lot to me, I kept holding off on telling them the thing they needed to know. And part of it was because I was afraid to hurt their feelings. But when I'm really honest with myself, which this requires a level of, you know, self-awareness, I was also worried about my own feelings. I didn't want to be sort of the bad guy. I wanted everyone to like me. My fear of conflict, sort of the people pleasing, which would be, you know, more about that manipulative insincerity. So it's really an interesting framework. You know, think if somebody had spinach in their teeth, you know, the obnoxiously aggressive thing, you'd sort of throw a dental floss at them in front of everyone. And now everyone knows they have spinach, you know, but it's, you've embarrassed them. And manipulative insincerity, if someone had spinach, you would, you wouldn't talk about them, but we do this exercise in a workshop. You wouldn't tell them directly. You'd talk about them behind their back. They created a Slack channel called Charlie's Teeth, and invited everyone to the Slack channel except Charlie. Now, you think something like this doesn't happen, but this happens all the time, where people are having these side conversations. Think about it in a video meeting and they're sending sort of separate chats. And I can't believe they just said that. Is anyone going to say anything? Or it's like the meeting after the meeting, like, why didn't you say something? You know, we're not talking to each other. And somehow we think by talking about that person, they're going to fix it. But it's really unhealthy. And then ruinous empathy is like, you don't say anything because you don't want to hurt their feelings, but you might say like, oh, you're going to do great in that meeting, ignoring like the big hunk of spinach. And so that's a very kind of simple example, but it illustrates these behaviors that happen all the time at work. And to illustrate, like, just a super quick example of radical candor, and we can get into it more, but I was doing a workshop a couple of years ago in person, and I'm left-handed, so I was writing on the board, and it was this blue marker, and this woman pulled me to the side. We were doing some breakouts. She said, "Amy, I love the workshop. I'm getting so much out of it." And she really seemed to mean it. You know, I really felt like that care and that connection. Then she said, "I did just want to let you know because I would want to know." And that actually was really instructive because it was like, I felt like she was doing this to be helpful. She said, "You have blue marker all over your chin." And that was like all that she needed to do. She actually went, "You don't have to solve the problem," but she happened to have one of those little like travel mirrors. She's like, "See, it's right here." I mean, there was blue marker, yeah. Like my whole chin was blue. And, but she did it. She pulled me to the side, you know, so she criticized me in private. She connected me, you know, the sort of, I would want to know. It was very helpful. It was very quick. And I share that just to say, sometimes people think like, oh, you know, I don't know this person, or I couldn't do it, or, you know, but she built that rapport really, really quickly. And I'll often ask, you know, another thing people say is, oh, but I could never do that to my CEO or, you know, someone several layers up. And I've asked leaders, you know, if you had spinach in your teeth, and again, this is maybe a simple example, but it happens, would this build trust with you if someone sort of lower in the organization, or would you want, you know, everyone wants to know, and it would build trust, but we sometimes think, oh, I'm not ready yet at that part of the relationship. And so at its highest level, it's about building one-on-one relationships that are kind and clear.
And I think that's so important right now as a feedback culture, because, you know, after 2 years being locked down, being isolated, what have you, and doing everything over Zoom and Teams, a lot of meetings just become transactional because I got to run. What is it, Amy? Tell me what you got.
Right.
Bang, 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 bang. Okay, this is what I got. Bang, bang, bang. See you later. I got to go. And after 2 years, we get used to this. And so I think taking the time to build that, what do you call it? Challenge directly and care personally on that axis.
Yeah.
To radical candor. And for those non-English speakers, candor just means to be straightforward, to be honest, to be real, to speak your mind in a diplomatic way.
Yeah, I love that you brought that in. We do workshops all over the world. And one of my favorite things is to tell a story about a time when I received radical candor. And I tell a story about when I received some criticism from my boss about how I had been in a meeting and I thought the meeting went really great. And then after the meeting, you know, he really in a very caring way, like shared what went well in the meeting. But he also said, you know, I was completely ignoring the people on my team. I was so focused on the CEO and the CFO that the rest of my team was actually really pissed off with me, which I would have had no idea if he hadn't told me. And so one of the things I do is, you know, well, think about what does care personally mean to you? Think about challenge directly. What does that mean to you? And so for me, some of the things that this person did was, you know, a very heavy door fell on me. They stayed up on the phone with me all night. But even that program I was sharing with you, the organization didn't want to invest in my training in that Search Inside Yourself program. But this boss knew how important it was for my own personal development and found funding, even if the organization wasn't as invested. And so it's these moments where you feel like this person kind of has got your back. They're looking out for you. They're seeing you as a real human being, and they're willing to challenge you directly. In that case, to say, you know, I'm worried you're going to lose your team. And to sort of tell you that difficulty. And just back to the point of candor, you know, Kim very intentionally chose the word candor and not truth. And the reason for that is because, you know, truth has this sense of this is it. And candor is really, here's how I see it. How do you see it? And there's really an element of humility here, which is like, it's about, I'm sharing my perspective, you know, hey, Jason, here's how I see it. Mm. How do you see it? I mean, I have, you know, what I've observed, and we have very specific ways of saying, you know, in this meeting, you know, you weren't able to answer the CFO's questions. And as a result, I'm concerned that the CFO doesn't feel like we have put together a thoughtful analysis. And as a next step, let's meet next week and review that proposal prior to going through with the CEO, for example. So there's some real specificity there, but it's really about, here's how I see it. Going back to that conversation I was talking about with my boss, Jason, which was like, here's how I see it. How do you see it? And this person's going to have a whole different perspective. And so that's why we call it candor. The other thing in the newest edition of the book, Radical Candor, we also call it compassionate candor, because sometimes people were using radical candor, the phrase, as an excuse to be like a jerk, to act like a jerk, to say, in the spirit of radical candor, and so the compassion is really the care. What makes it radical actually is that it's so rare. It's rare that we feel like we can be both.
And it's just so important to operate. It just shows you in communication, we need to operationally define everything so we're on the same page.
Everything. Yeah. I mean, and then you're working globally. And that's when I think even with mindfulness, with leadership, like we all have these stories of what these words mean. And you nailed something, which is, you know, you hit sort of right on the head, which is, what does this mean to you? And so that's part of why we ask folks to define in their own words. And that's why we love storytelling. Tell a story when you receive some radical candor. By the way, praise is also just as important, if not more important, as criticism.
Agreed.
But when you put it in your own story, what does it mean to you? Why does it matter to you? What does care personally, challenge directly mean to you? It's going to look very different to you than to me, than to Kim, and people that you work with. You need to understand what it means to them.
So I think that that whole feedback culture and the clear instructions of how, or the radical candor philosophy or methodology is very clear. It's very immediate. Because it, I think what has happened, psychological safety has become so much more important as we return to the things. Mm-hmm. We understand this camaraderie, this cohesiveness that we've missed for so long. But the thing is, what I see as a challenge is that psychological safety is losing. It's just becoming management speaking. So when I'm working in organizations or directly with teams, I bring it down to a neuroscience level. I talk about social pain and social reward. And these social rewards that are so important, it's to nail it. And how do you do that? Well, it's the feedback. And the radical candor methodology is a very simple but elegant way to do that. In the last part of our conversation, Amy talks about the resilient organization, about the resilient leader, manager, employee. And to become resilient means the ability to embrace change, to embrace learning, to embrace some level of uncertainty. And sometimes that is about having difficult conversations, to be radically candid with people. We also talk about the importance of empathy. And I think empathy is the magic ingredient. It is the key. It is the linchpin to having difficult conversations. If we show up with empathy, and we've talked about this before between cognitive and emotional empathy, but if our empathy is genuine, sincere, and we're coming from a good place, that makes all the difference when we're having these conversations to help move people forward. Now, radical candor works very well for those people who have a certain level of self-confidence where they can confront someone. They can see conflict in a constructive way. Mm-hmm. What is your advice for someone who, you know, let's say the team is psychologically safe, but it has to do with their own inner critic, an individual. She or he wants to give feedback, but they feel, they don't have the confidence. I mean, you have the whole setup there of radical candor. And it's a very elegant way to do that. But how does someone get over their own inner threshold, to have that conversation?
Well, I love that question because it really speaks directly to me and my own personal experience. First, just to say that I am personally, and as an organization, we're huge fans of Amy Edmondson and her work on psychological safety, you know, out of Harvard Business School. And candor is a big part of that psychological safety. And the model of radical candor is really about these one-on-one relationships. And in an ideal world, you know, Kim Scott, when she wrote the book, it was about, it was actually targeted for managers and for bosses, right? Because she was very aware that you sort of need to lay the power down and to help create some of that safety. We've been training folks, everything from, you know, CEOs and mid-level managers to individual contributors. And I will just share, that one of the challenges for some folks is exactly what you're talking about. How do I build that confidence, that capacity, that courage? And that was very much my own journey. I mean, I would not be teaching radical candor, I would not be practicing as well, let alone teaching it, if I did not have that mindfulness and emotional self-awareness, emotional regulation, and really the courage to practice. And so one of the things, and I keep saying practice, part of this is actually a function of practice. And the more that you can actually practice and build the muscle and realize like, oh, I had that conversation with Jason and it actually strengthened our relationship. And we've had multiple conversations like that. And he's rewarded it. You know, we talk about sort of rewarding the candor. And so a couple of tips that we talk about just sort of to operationalize this, especially for folks that want to build that courage muscle. And then for folks that work with, you know, maybe you have someone that reports to you and they're not giving you the kind of feedback you think, maybe they're afraid or they're reluctant to do it. First of all, we talk about an order of operations. How do I practice radical candor? It is not the boss giving the report criticism. We actually start by soliciting feedback, by getting feedback. Since you're a, you know, neuroscience guy, there's a quote that I love from David Rock out of, the Neuro Leadership Institute And so it's something like, you know, there's a big difference when somebody says, can I give you some feedback? Like the response is basically the same as, you know, a saber-toothed tiger. You know, it's like that question, just like all of a sudden it's like that fight, flight, freeze, and we're in that panic zone. And so what we flip that so that we actually solicit feedback. we start by soliciting feedback. And then we want to be giving folks praise. We want to be showing people what they're doing well, as well as what's not working well, but really actually giving more praise, and not in a sort of insincere way, but in a really specific way. We use a certain model, which I can go into in just a moment. So we get it, we give it, we give more praise than criticism, and then we need to gauge it. And this one's really, really important. And sometimes people will ask, you know, is there sort of an absolute measure of radical candor? And the answer is no, because it's really going to depend on who this person is, who you are, what's your relationship. So something I say to you might land like radical candor, but for someone else, it might land like I was being a real jerk. And for someone else, they might not even, you know, have heard a challenge. And so it's so important in these conversations. And by the way, I could say something to you right now. It might land one way, and then, you know, maybe you're having a rough day tomorrow and it's going to land a different day, right? You know, all exactly. of these things
so
change.
Many
so it's really
right?
so many variables. Mm-hmm. And in one conversation, you could go through sort of each of these different quadrants. And so that agility, that's where that mindfulness, that sort of moment to moment agility of I'm saying something, you know, how is it landing for you? You know, I was trying to be kind and clear here. You know, how did that land? But looks like I missed the mark, right? And then encouraging it, you know, as a team, there's ways that you can encourage it. So just to kind of double click on this first step, which is getting feedback, I think this is really important because, you know, first of all, we like to do this in one-on-one meetings. We like to bake it into meetings that we already have. To your point about one of the things I love about radical candor, this isn't about like finding 20 extra hours in our day. This is about, you know, if I'm working with you on a project, if I'm in a one-on-one meeting, I spend some time to check in with you. And a good question could be, you know, what's one thing I did in the last week that made it tough to work with me? One question I love, because I tend to have micromanaging tendencies, is, you know, in the last week, where did I get involved where you wish I hadn't? You know, Amy, I did not need you on that project. Or in the last week, you wish I had gotten involved. Maybe you tend to be more, you know, sort of work on your own. Another question that I love is, you know, hey, Jason, here's what I was trying to accomplish on this project. How would you have thought about it differently? I think especially cross-functionally, people are working on so many, we don't know what people are working on. You could also ask your boss this, you know, I was trying to do this. How would you have thought about it? And so really that soliciting of feedback to build a relationship, to your point about the sort of transactional, you know, we're sort of in and out these meetings. We're just sort of getting the work done, but we're not taking the time to invest in the care part, in the relationship. So even just a few minutes at the top, how are you doing? What's going on? You know, is there one way I could support you in the next week? We do listening exercises, just 2.5 minutes of focused listening. People can go deeper and connect. So that is really step one, is actually soliciting feedback before we start dishing it out. You got to show you can take it before you start dishing it out, if folks will know that American phrase.
Yeah. But I think that is such a thing. It's soliciting. And for those who don't know, that means to ask for feedback. Because I
correct.
You know, when you're working in, obviously, as you said, the cross-functionals, when you have teams that they're doing their own things. And so there's a number of things I just want to rewind, because I think you made some salient points just to kind of open it up there. You know, I think when teams are working, sometimes they get so detailed into their particular tasks that they lose sight of the bigger picture, how the jigsaw puzzle works together. But if one group says to another, and you have these unintentional silos that build up. Mm-hmm. So if, as you said, if I am team A and you're team B, and I come to you guys, hey guys, you know, here's 5 questions. Here's 3 days, but we'd really like the feedback, because we're not talking about the business, but how we contribute to building the business together. You know, what are we doing well? That's usually easy for them to answer, because, okay, that's easy, right? And then it's like, okay, what is one or two things we can improve? What is what more or less do you need from us to make things flow between us? What could we either change or eliminate? But because I think it's that by asking for feedback, it's almost like an olive branch, and it almost creates this reciprocity where they feel that, you know what, they've opened up, let us do the same. And then you create this culture. At first it may seem awkward, but over time it becomes part of the DNA of how these teams work together, and it just becomes what they do. I don't know, once every month or once every second month.
Well, even more frequent. Yeah. And I mean, I love how you framed it, you know, because we really see this as the more we can get these conversations to be frequent, not an annual performance review, no. Like, you know, we do not want surprises. These are ongoing. These should be kind of just a few minute sort of developmental organization. What's working well, you know, one specific thing you did in that presentation that really captivated my attention, you know, really, and being very specific, you know, we like to use context, you know, in this very meeting, well said. Like in the meeting with the CFO, the observation, you know, there was a very complex growth rate that you explained succinctly. Like this is where you're not saying you're a genius. You're not saying you're an idiot, just, you know, what you observed, one thing. Mm-hmm. And then I think one of the most important things is to really think through the result. Why does this matter to that person? Mm-hmm. And do I know them well enough to know, you know, well, it matters because now we're going to get the funding request, or it matters because now mm-hmm. you're on track for promotion. Do I even know what motivates them? And then thinking about a next step. So just to go back to, you know, first of all, the need for being specific, one specific thing. And then with the go-to question, the asking for feedback, as you were sharing, I love the idea of the olive branch. It shows that I am signaling to you, I really want to hear what you have to say. Your perspective is important to me. So there's a couple of really important things. When you said this actually might be tough, it might be tough. There could be some discomfort when you start to do this. First of all, they might not want to give you the feedback. Like, well, do they really want it? Or are they just saying, they're just like, now they went to some seminar and now they're checking a box, you know? So it has to be in your own, it has to be in your own words, you know, put it in your own words. And it also has to take into account the other person's communication style. Like we were just talking about the podcast recently, Kim has this question, you know, what's one thing I could start or stop doing that would make it easier to work with me? Well, Jason doesn't like that question. So Kim asked Jason a different question. You know, it doesn't need to be sort of, it's like written on high. And we do this all the time in our workshops where we'll do a workshop over a couple of weeks. We'll introduce this idea of the go-to question. And then I'll check in with them, you know, did you give a piece of specific and sincere praise? And yes, people did. And they really like that. And then had the go-to question go, well, it is totally normal, natural for it to not go as well because, oh, well, they didn't know, everything's fine.
Well said.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. And so part of it just has to become the habit and to frame it like, hey, Jason, the only way I'm going to get better, this is important for my own growth. The only way I'm going to get better at this is if you tell me. And one way I like to do this is to sort of tee it up for that person. Say, hey, Jason, I know that I talk a lot in meetings and it's really important for me to help the more introverted folks feel like they can get a word in edgewise. So we're going into this meeting. I'm going to end the meeting 5 minutes early. So we'll have a chance to actually check in. And then I'm going to check in with you and say, hey, what worked well? And what could I have done better, especially to include people? And then finally, when people give you criticism that you've asked for, this is a gift, right? Treat it like a gift, change what you can change. If you don't agree, take some time to really sort of consider it and then just have a thoughtful conversation. Because if you do not reward that candor, you are not going to get it again. So it's exactly, really important to treat it like a gift. Say, hey, thank you so much. Mm. Yeah. And we actually, just speaking of words, we like to use the word guidance. I mean, I know that feedback is the word that's out in the marketplace, but for me, guidance has that more of that coaching idea, which is like, hey, here's where we can go, especially with praise. Praise is like, hey, this is specifically what worked well. Sometimes people say, great job on the website. Well, what was great about it? Like that, I can't replicate that, but what you can replicate is, you know, the specific inputs, right? And then it just feels like BS if somebody says this. So it's gotta be specific. And we like to say it's specific and sincere, kind and
clear. Yeah, the why behind the what. Because when it comes to people building self-confidence to have these conversations, because once you have that, when you can pass that threshold, then it's okay, because you've defined or reframed conflict as a constructive, not for conflict, but it is a form of conflict, but you see it as helping people to develop these constructive dialogues. But what I find is, you know, one thing is if mindfulness, but I think it's also hiring a coach such as yourself so people can, they can role play, they can talk about it, because if they can talk about it, their brain's already experienced it. And that experience, it tempers their expectations.
Yeah.
It makes it more real. And that's at least what I find when I'm coaching people. You know, I'm asking them tough questions and to temper their expectations. And when their expectations go on, they've reframed it and they have that moral confidence because we've gone through it a few times.
I love that, Jason. Can I share a quick story with you about what helped me? awesome. So first of all, 100% on the practice. When we do these workshops, we have this exercise of feedback triangle where people practice giving and receiving, and you have an actual coach in the room there. You know, you don't usually get this in a conversation. We get a coach for sports, but we don't usually get a feedback coach where they're like, Amy, I really felt the care, but then, wow, you just really came in guns a-blazing there. You really need to dial it back. Right. But that is so, so helpful. And people find real emotion, even though it's a quote role play, I'm really getting frustrated or I'm really feeling embarrassed. Right. So 100% on practice and on coaching. And I will just say, for me, one of the ways that I have really kind of built the muscle of courage is putting myself in difficult situations. And I do a very active breath work that I mentioned, and I have a lot of trust for my teacher. His name is David Elliott. And for about 6 New Year's Eves over the past 10 or 15 years, I have done a fire walk with David. And this fire walk is something that I put myself into this difficult position because I know when I come out the other side, I will have greater awareness. And I think for me, it's become such a great model of how change happens. First of all, there's been all of this relationship building between sort of the land and the trees and sort of the area of nature that this is happening in and the fire itself. And you sort of put what you're willing to let go of in the fire. But in the fire walk itself, you look up at the sky and there's a star, and you actually put your focus on that star and it becomes a word. So what your intention is, like clarity or love kind, whatever. And so, you know, I'm sure in your coaching, you do this too, sort of what's your intention or what's your motivation? So you have sort of this one word kind of, or two words sort of motivation or anchor you're looking up. And then you have the group to the side of the, you know, the fiery hot coals, and they start chanting the sort of, my body will do whatever it must to let me walk on fire. And you sort of get into this heightened state because you've been that way also through the breath work, and you're looking up. And there's sort of this group support. So for me, it's like, you've got the star, your intention, you've got this group support. And then David's there, his sister's there, and he's literally got a hand on your back. And then you start saying your intention, you know, love or courage or confidence, whatever. And then you go. And I've never once gotten burned. It's been this sort of transcendent experience. And there can be science around what's actually happening there. But for me, again, with this sort of experimental mindset, is that what I have taken away from that is that, first of all, I've done it. So I have the cellular memory of knowing that even I've done it 6 times, and it was only the last time where I didn't have that, like, holy crap, why am I doing that? You know, that sort I'd sort of, it sort of gotten wired in. And the last time I did was actually going into 2020. And the word I had was thank you. And just this feeling of gratitude, which I think is also just a really important practice. But I share that because I put myself into these positions of, and this is maybe a little bit more extreme, but this is really important to me because as a teacher, I need to keep sort of growing and pushing myself. And I just think it's like, what's that little next step that's a little out of your comfort zone? And how can you be supported by a group? And how can you be supported by a coach that we do not have to do this alone? And so, especially with something like radical candor, we love having this idea of like success partners, people to practice with. Don't do it. Don't feel like you have to do it alone. It's hard for everyone. And for me, that's why I love working with coaches. I'm someone that's a big believer in getting that extra support and that really sort of positive peer support as well.
I mean, you can learn Taekwondo from a book, but it's better to go to dojo and have a black belt teach you. You can learn to swing a golf club, but it's better to go to a golf pro. It's the same thing with you. I mean, if someone wants to know this, go to the mindful leader, the radical candor coach, Amy Sand. But can I ask you? You were saying to push yourself. So it's constantly to embrace the struggle, to grow, because we're either growing or we're growing or sliding. And so by doing that, and I think about when it comes back down to the day-to-day about someone building the courage to have a difficult conversation, I think that also embracing the struggle is also about sometimes just try low-hanging fruit. Just give someone some feedback about something that, you know, there's not going to be major blowback on. There could just be a little thing. It's just saying, talking about the shoes or their hair or the coffee or whatever. I don't know. I'm just pulling things out of the air now. But I think that's a great way to start to build up the confidence.
To build the muscle. Yeah, I love that. And I think even with the soliciting feedback, the asking for feedback, getting feedback, even just with, you know, sort of a, like a trusted friend, you could say, and one way you can really sort of sort of tamper down the potential stakes is like ask for the kind of feedback that you want. Right. So it could be maybe you just put a presentation deck together. And so you say, okay, Jason, I feel really good about this presentation deck. The feedback that would be most helpful is this one slide. I feel like it's there's too many words on the page. What's one thing I could do to make this more succinct? Right. And starting to build the muscle. Go ahead. Yeah,
and that also helps the person to give you feedback because, you know, you're creating certain constraints or guidance or guide rails, and they can be a little more specific because it's very objective. It's very pragmatic. Do this, do this, do this. Or I think you could do this, this, or this. So I think that's very important. I'm just respectful of your time, Amy, because I know you have another meeting to get to in a minute. But when it comes to, like when you said to practice gratitude, and when you're trying to share feedback, empathy is going to be a large part of that, to show empathy for the other group. I was wondering, have you come across when there's too much empathy?
Specifically about ruinous empathy, then we can talk about other stuff, but ruinous empathy, I think it becomes ruinous when there's no action. So empathy is critical. It's foundational to our practice, to being human. Joan Halifax is someone I deeply admire. She's a Zen priest and has written a lot about empathy. But empathy becomes ruinous, especially when you look at caregivers, when people sort of get overwhelmed and burnt out by empathy and there's not action. And so for me, compassion, and there's actually really interesting research from Matthew Ricard, whose brain was studied around the distinction between empathy and compassion. Compassion is really this active desire to relieve the suffering. If we get empathy is foundational, is required, it's step one. But without then that action in service of, you know, sort of relieving the suffering, sort of acting with. And so it's like we need the empathy plus the action. And that's why I really like the radical candor model, because it's not just about sort of the feeling with, it's actually doing something, it's saying something. If we're feeling with that person, but we're not actually saying something to be of service, it's not helping, right? I mean, I think about the times when I've received, you know, the story I shared where my boss told me what was happening in that meeting. Had I not received that feedback, which would have been very easy, I'm very sensitive, you know, recovering perfectionist, would have been very easy for him not to share that feedback with me. It would have had really negative consequences for me. And so we had the courage, you know, often you think, oh, well, I really like this person, so I can't tell them that. But if you really do, it's not so caring after all, if you're not telling them, right? And so I do think it's an act of courage to tell them this thing. It's like, we're not a perfect proxy for that other person, but would I want to know, you know, would you want to know? And so that's when empathy can become ruinous. I think in other examples, when we don't say things because we're maybe worried of blowback for us, this is why it's really important, but this is why radical candor is practiced one-on-one, right? Mm. And so I really want people to understand that relationships don't scale, but culture does. So if I'm building a relationship, you're on my team, Jason, and there's someone else on my team and someone else, I am going to build these one-on-one relationships where I'm soliciting feedback from you. I'm giving radically candid praise, kind and clear. We're having this back and forth. You're challenging me. I'm challenging you. And that is how we create a culture of radical candor. And there's a lot of other content in the book around how to have meetings and how to actually create and encourage this kind of culture so that if you're the boss, like people are having these conversations directly. I think one of the hardest things is, you know, one person comes to you complaining about the other person, that person comes to you complaining about that person. Mm-hmm. That's the only time it's not good to listen. We want people talking to each other. And I think that's where, you know, there's the empathy and the action. That's why we call it compassionate candor.
And I think that is such I love that term. I didn't know you called that compassionate candor. I like that much more than radical candor because it gets much more to the point. It's much more relatable and understandable to people. And there's not that misunderstanding. Because when it comes back to it, what I hear through this whole conversation that for a company to be resilient and its individuals to be resilient, it is about giving a feedback culture and it's having the courage. You're going to have the fear sometimes about, but it's stepping up and having that conversation and not worried about getting your head bitten off by being candid, by sharing my perspective, not the truth, but my perspective of what's going on. And I think,
yeah. And I just want to add, because I didn't say it, it's to be helpful. Like it's really important. Yes, you are sharing your perspective in service of this person's growth. Right. And so we want to be humble. We want to be helpful, but I think that's really important. I'm not saying this because I'm really like, I might have a lot of frustration this happened, but I have to really, am I saying this because this is going to really be of service to Jason? Or am I saying it just because I'm really ticked off and I'm stressed and I'm, you know, and so that's why it's these one-on-one relationships that we're really wanting to build.
And it's developing those one-to-ones, because just to add a little neuroscience, because empathy is so core to this, because empathy is so important in this case, because what we know is that there's an empathy network, but once we feel independent that I don't really need Amy, then empathy goes off. But all of a sudden, if I start interjecting and peppering our language with what is the goal we're trying to achieve together? What is the outcome we're trying to achieve? Because once we start using collective pronouns and language, that actually fires off the empathy. Because all of a sudden we feel dependent upon each other. And that creates more feedback culture, I think.
Yes. I love that. Actually, that's such a great point. We'll often debrief from these sort of feedback triangles. Well, people practice and we try to get little nuggets. What worked well? Usually questions worked really well. Listening to understand worked really well. People go into these conversations thinking they want to have they have something specific they want to say. And they all of a sudden this person has a whole different perspective. But something else works really well is exactly what you said. Shifting from you have to do this to how are we going to look at this, right? That sort of coaching mentality, sort of, I've got your back. Like, let's think this through together. How can we get to a better outcome together? Because it's all about collaboration. Radical candor is in service of us getting stuff done together, and collaboration works a whole lot better than telling people what to do.
Well, Amy Sandler, thank you very much for your time. You are a Renaissance woman, a coach, a podcast host, a mindful leader, mindfulness trainer. You're right. A firewalker, a coal walker. You got to send me an invite next time you do that for the seventh time. I'll be there.
I would love it. I love this conversation. Great questions, great insights. And I so appreciate the work that you're doing in the world.
Well, ditto. Was there any last thing you'd like to say before we say goodbye?
Well, I loved your question about courage. I do think that's foundational. And I think the benefit of a model like Radical Candor is that you can take some comfort in the structure and in the guidelines, and also that you don't have to do it alone. When you have a couple of folks, one other person, you know, start to practice this with someone else, and it can really help you build the muscle of Radical Candor. It's a practice, and it's something I like to do every day.
Well said. That's a perfect soundbite. Thank you, Amy, for your generous time. I will make sure that I have all the links to the book, all the links in the notes and such, in the podcast notes. But thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
Well, another giant thank you to Amy for spending some time with me today, spending some time with us today. It was a fantastic conversation. And it's always great to talk with someone who's of like mind. It is. For me, it is. But anyways, folks, I highly recommend you pick up the book Radical Candor. If you're interested in Amy Sandler's work, her mindfulness, or anything else, you're looking for a great coach, well, Amy's your woman. I will leave all her contact information in the podcast notes. And you can find the book, link to the book there too. And you can find it in all formats. But thanks again, Amy. That was brilliant. Anyways, folks, that leads us to the end of another episode. As usual, please, a little homework. Like, share, subscribe. And if you can, recommend it to two people. But I always appreciate it when you can do that. But anyways, folks, thanks again. Thanks again for showing up for another week. Well, until next week, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.